The gold was in small pieces, mostly in the pierced round beads, from which the string had long ago rotted away. But there were flakes and flecks of thinly beaten foil, which might once have been used to decorate a votive wooden carving. There were coils of fine gold wire, and more rarely, small ingots of the metal, the size and thickness of a child's finger. Once the green stone birds must have stood in a circle, facing inwards, like the granite columns of Stonehenge. And the gold had probably formed some part of the offerings and sacrifices made to them. Whoever had thrown down the statues had scattered and trampled the sacrifice, and time had corroded all except that lovely yellow incorruptible metal. Within 10 days of first hacking away the undergrowth that choked the inner courtyard, the temple yard, as Zuga called it, they had gleaned over 50 pounds weight of native gold, and the interior of the stone courtyard had been gutted, the earth rutted and harrowed, as though a troop of wild bush pig had rooted it out. Then Zuga turned his full attention to the twin towers. He measured them around the base, over 100 paces, and inspected each joint in the masonry for a secret opening. There was none. So he built a rickety ladder of raw timber and bark rope, and risking neck and limb, reached the top of the tallest tower. From this vantage point, he could look down into the roofless passageways and courtyards of the city. It was a maze, all of it choked with growth. But there was no other part as promising as the temple courtyard of the bird statues. He turned his attention back to the tower on which he stood. There was again no sign of a secret opening, although he searched diligently for one. It puzzled him that the ancient architect would have built such a solid structure with no apparent use or motive. And the possibility occurred to him that it might be a sealed treasure house built around an inner chamber. The work of trying to penetrate the massive stonework daunted even Zuga, and Yanshirut declared the attempt to be madness. But Zuga had exhausted the digging below the tower, and this seemed to be the only fruitful area left to him. Complaining bitterly, a small team led by Matthew climbed the rickety ladder and under Zuga's supervision began prising loose the small blocks from the summit of the tower. However, such was the skill and dedication of the original masons that progress in the demolition was painfully slow, and there was a long pause between each crash of one loose block into the courtyard below and the next. It needed 3 days' unremitting toil to break a jagged aperture through the first layer of dressed blocks and to discover that the interior of the tower consisted merely of a fill of the same grey granite. Standing beside him on the summit of the tower, Yanshirut voiced Zuga's own disappointment. "Ach, we're wasting our time. It's stone and more stone," he spat over the side of the tower and watched the speck of phlegm float down into the ransacked courtyard. "What we should look for is the place the gold came from." Zuga had been so obsessed by his search and plunder of the ruined and deserted city that he had paid no thought to the mines which must lie somewhere beyond the walls. Now he nodded his head thoughtfully. "No wonder your mother loved you," he said. "Not only are you beautiful, but you're clever also." "Ja," Yanshirut nodded smugly. "Everybody tells me that." At that moment, a fat, weighty drop of rain struck Zuga's forehead and ran down into his left eyeball so that his vision blurred. The drop was warm as blood, warm as the blood of a man racked by malarial fever. Beyond the high walls, there were other ruins, none of such proportions or importance as the inner city, and all of them so scattered, so overgrown and thrown down as to make detailed exploration of them out of the question in the time still available to Zuga. The kopjes around the city had been fortified, but were deserted, the caves empty as the eye sockets of a long-dead skull, smelling of the leopards and rock rabbits who were the latest tenants. But Zuga concentrated his search on the ancient mine workings, which he had convinced himself had formed the backbone of this vanished civilization. He imagined deep shafts driven inside a hillside, and dumps of loose rock like the ancient Cornish tin mines, and he scoured the densely wooded country for miles in each direction, eagerly checking each irregularity of ground, each eminence that could possibly be an abandoned mine dump. He left Yanshirut to oversee the scratching and sweeping up of the last tiny scraps of gold in the temple yard, and all the men profited by the new relaxed supervision. They shared views with Yanshirut on the role of menial work in the life of a warrior and hunter. The first spattering of rain had been only a warning of the fury to come, and it had barely wet Zuga's shirt through to the skin before passing. But it was a warning that Zuga realized he was ignoring at his own peril. Yet still, the hope of the ancient mine workings, with their fat golden seams of the precious metal, tantalized him, and he spun out the days until even Yanshirut began to worry. "If the river Spate will be trapped here," he brooded beside the campfire. "Besides, we've taken all the gold. Let's go now and live to spend it." "One more day," Zuga promised him, as he settled into his single blanket and composed himself to sleep. "There is a valley just beyond the southern ridge. It'll take me only another day to search it." "The day after tomorrow," he promised sleepily. Zuga smelled the snake first. The sweet, sickening stench of it filled his nostrils. So he drew each breath with difficulty, yet trying not to gasp or choke, lest he call the snake's attention. He could not move. He was pinned under an immense dark weight which threatened to crush his ribs, and the smell of snake suffocated him. He could barely turn his head towards the place from which he knew the snake would come, and it came flowing sinuously, coil upon thick undulating coil. Its head was lifted, its eyes were unblinking and glassily fixed in the cold and deadly reptilian stare. The ribbon of its tongue flickered in a soft black blur through the icy smile of its thin, curved lips. Its scales scratched softly across the earth, and they glittered with a soft metallic sheen, the colour of the polished gold foil that Zuga had gleaned from the temple courtyard. Zuga could not move nor cry out. His tongue had swollen with terror to fill his mouth and choke him, but the snake slid past him, close enough to touch, if he had had command of his arms to reach out. It slid into the circle of soft wavering light, and the shadows drew back, so the birds emerged from the darkness, each on its elevated perch. Their eyes were golden and fierce, the cruel yellow curve of their beaks echoed by the proud pout of their russet-flecked breasts, and the long pinions folded across their backs like crossed blades. Though Zuga knew they were hunting falcons with belled tresses on their legs, yet they were the size of golden eagles. They were decked with garlands of flowers, crimson blossoms of kingshaka fire, and the snowy virginal white of arum lilies. They wore necklaces and chains of brightest gold about their arrogant necks, and as the serpent slid into the midst of the circle, they stirred upon their perches. Then as the serpent raised its glittering head with the crest of scales erect upon the back of its neck, the falcons burst into thunderous flight, and the darkness was filled with the roar of their wings and the plaintive lament of their wild hunting cries. Zuga lifted his hands to shield his face. The great wings beat all about him as the flock of falcons took flight, and the presence of the snake was no longer of significance. What was important was the departure of the birds. Zuga felt a tremendous sense of doom, of personal loss, and he opened his mouth, able to utter again. He shouted at the birds to call them back to roost. He shouted into the darkness after the soaring, buffeting thunder of the birds' wings, and his own shouts and the cries of his servants woke him from the coils of the nightmare. He woke to find the night was thunderous with the wind of the storm that swept down upon the camp. The trees tossed and thrashed their branches overhead, showering them with leaves and small twigs, and the rush of air was glacially cold. It stripped the thatch from their crudely built huts, and it scattered ash and live coals from the fire. The coals fanned into new life were the only source of light, for overhead the stars were obscured by the thick rolling banks of cloud that pressed close upon the earth. Shouting to each other above the wind, they scrambled to collect their scattered equipment. "Make sure the powder bags are kept dry," Zuga bellowed. naked except for his tattered breeches, and barefooted as he groped for his boots. "Sergeant Chirrut, where are you?" The Hottentot's reply was lost in the cannon's roar of thunder that drove their eardrums in, and the flash of lightning that followed immediately seared their eyeballs and imprinted on Zuga's vision the unforgettable picture of Jan Chirrut dancing stark naked on one foot, a red-hot coal from the scattered fire stuck to the sole of the other, his wild curses lost in the drawn-out roll of the thunder, and his face contorted like that of a gargoyle on the parapet of Notre-Dame Cathedral. Then the darkness fell on them again, like an avalanche, and out of it came the rain. It came in cutting horizontal sheets, like the blade of a harvester's scythe, so thick that it filled the air with water, so they coughed and gasped like drowning men. It came with such hissing force that it stung their naked skins as though coarse salt had been fired at them from a shotgun barrel, and the cold chilled them to the bone, so that they crawled into a forlorn huddle, crowding together for comfort and warmth, with the sodden fur blankets pulled over their heads and stinking like a pack of wet dogs. The cold, gloomy dawn found them still huddled from the silver streams of falling rain, under the swollen, bruised sky that pressed down upon them like the belly of a pregnant sow. Scattered and sodden equipment floated or was submerged in the ankle-deep flood of water that poured through the wind-shattered camp. The lean-to shelters had been wrecked. The campfire was a muddy, black puddle of ash. There was no prospect of rebuilding it. And with that went any chance of hot food or comfort for their stiff, cold bodies. Zuga had wrapped the powder bags in strips of oilskin, and he and Jan Chirrut had held them in their laps, like ailing infants, during the night. However, it was impossible to open the bags and check the contents for damp, for the rain still teemed down out of the low grey sky in long, thin silver lances. Slipping and sloshing in the muddy footing, Zuga drove his men to make up their loads for the outward march, while he made his own final preparations. In the middle of the morning, they ate a miserable and hasty meal of cold millet cakes and the last scraps of smoked buffalo meat. Then Zuga stood, with a cloak of half-cured kudu skin draped over his head and shoulders, the rain dripping from his beard and plastering his patched clothing to his body. "Safari!" he shouted. "We march!" "And not too damn soon either," muttered Jan Chirrut, reversing his musket on its sling, so the barrel pointed at the ground and the rain could not run into the muzzle. It was then that the porters discovered the extra burden that Zuga had for them. It was lashed to carrying poles of mapani wood with bark rope and protected by a plaited covering of elephant grass.
"They not going to carry that?" Jan Chirrut told him,
squeezing the rein from his woolly eyebrows with his thumb.
"I told you they would refuse."
"They'll carry it." Zuga's eyes were cold and green as cut emeralds, and his expression was fierce. "They carry it, or they'll stay here with it dead."